Hey, what's going on? Welcome to Raptors Reasonablest. I'm your host, Blake Murphy. Joining me on the line, the game, Triple H, the cerebral assassin, the man who's just that damn good, Eric Kareem. What's up, man?
Not much. I was just saying before the show, I've changed my alarm to wake up in the morning to the game theme song by Motorhead, rest in peace, Lemmy. And it's great. Is one of the best decisions of my life, obviously. But then I get the song stuck in my head, which was already a problem. It would already pop into my head. I would say that and the Big Show's theme song, like just sometimes pop into my head for no reason. So this is only making that worse. So if I break out in that song, which I don't think I'm allowed to sing on here because of Vince McMahon's trademarks, I apologize.
And just in general, out of respect for the listeners.
I mean, they've heard worse on this. Yeah. They're arguably hearing worse on this right now.
Yeah. The game's theme song, by the way, I did a piece for The Athletic 2 summers ago on Ryan Borucki and his brother Matt. And how, like, they're huge wrestling fans, and, like, their dad used to drive them to baseball, and in the parking lot before they went to the Diamond, he would just blare the game theme music to get them pumped up. So that's what I think of now with that song. I've had 2 wrestling theme songs as my alarm before. Once when I was in, like, a months-long depression, I used the New Day theme, because I thought that it would wake me up in a better mood every day.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, and I also for a little bit used Bobby Roode's Glorious that actually speaking of you singing on the podcast, tried to sing recently.
I think I half sung it, because yeah. I think rightly concluded that not everybody would understand what the hell I was going for.
Yes, this is, our listenership is more of a New Japan listenership than a WWE listenership. So we're going to pivot from there to talk about the G1 Climax tournament coming this September. Huge risk for the Raptors because they are going head-to-head with the Brooklyn Nets in the first round of the playoffs, and New Japan superfan Joe Harris will only get more powerful as the G1 Climax tournament draws nearer. So
that, I believe, is a known fact. Prove it over time by Joe Harris's world championship performance last year.
Yep.
When America finished 8th.
Yeah. Yeah.
America. Assuming that's when the tournament happened last year, which I do not know. The G1
Speaking
Climax.
Of America. Donald Trump was not kind to the NBA this morning on the radio, apparently.
Oh,
friend of
that.
The podcast, Daniel Dale, thankfully tweeting out the quotes so we didn't have to listen to it. but boy, is that going to dominate the news cycle in a silly, silly way today. Thank God the Raptors don't have media availability today.
Yes and no, because it's always fun to see, like, if anybody pops off at it, but...
Odds of us getting Kyle Lowry and Masai Ujiri on a Tuesday after a back-to-back anyway are pretty low. And
do I want to write about it? No. Would I be entertained by some quotes? Yes.
We're heading for a second "you bum" is what we're heading toward here.
It could get more obscene, maybe. Let's hope so.
By the way, this is Donald Trump's issue is that with the NBA continuing to protest peacefully during anthems and things like that, which is a good time to remind everyone that the 3 police officers who killed Breonna Taylor remain free. We as a Raptors media have been tweeting out links to different issues that the players have wanted to talk about, like education reform and the ways systemic racism reveals itself in education, in things like voter suppression, in things like policing. There was a study from the Ontario Human Rights Commission this week that came out, and it was written up in the Toronto Star with a hilarious tweet of breaking black people disproportionately subject to X, Y, Z, and W from the police. And it's like, I'm not sure that's breaking.
I know what they were going for.
Yes,
they were,
the they study were going itself for the, just came out.
Yes, that
the
is...
The results are the opposite of breaking. They're 400 years in the breaking. anyway, a reminder once again that these players are not protesting the troops or the flag or anything like that. They are peacefully protesting police brutality and systemic racism in America and Canada and around the world. So please continue to actively engage with their message and earnestly engage with their message, because it's not some Marxist conspiracy or whatever else you want to choose to reframe these protests and these comments and these shirts and everything like that as. Engage with it earnestly and engage with it a lot, because that's the reason that basketball was even able to come back, that we engage with this stuff and that the players have this platform. I mentioned Joe Harris. The Raptors are locked into a 2-7 matchup with the Brooklyn Nets. We're going to touch on that just briefly at the end of this podcast, and we're going to come back with a full series preview podcast a little later in the week, or maybe early next week. It depends. We probably won't get the playoff schedule until all the seeding things are locked in, because you wouldn't want to put Kawhi Leonard in that tasty 2-7, 8:30 slot one night, and then the Clippers slide to the 3 seed and suddenly Kawhi's playing at noon or something like that. So we probably won't find out until the seeding's locked in. But we'll be back with you with our Nets beat writer for a series preview podcast. Before that gets going, we'll also, of course, there are two reseeding games for the Raptors left: Wednesday against the Philadelphia 76ers and Friday against the Denver Nuggets. We'll have regular coverage of those, but expect a quick turnaround to series preview content, because it is a tight window for a turnaround. We do know the opponents, we can get a little head start, and these last two games are completely meaningless for the Raptors beyond getting healthy. Also, if you didn't see the news, that Friday game that didn't have a time before, the Raptors will close out the reseeding schedule at 1:30 on Friday against Jamal Murray and your Denver Nuggets. Bowl against Chris Boucher. Let's go.
Here's a preview of the playoff preview podcast, though. Fuck Brooklyn, like.
Yes. What is it? I tweeted something the other day with the F word in it, and then deleted it because I don't like to have tweets with the F word in it all that often. But it was fuck whatever hotel Brooklyn's staying at, because they're not actually based in Brooklyn right now, but I can't remember the name of the hotel.
Yeah, it's not the Grandestino, I'll tell you that.
Yes, that's
potential
champions only in the Grandestino.
The roles of the 2014 series have flipped dramatically.
Yes, they have. And, you know, this will be the third time that the Raptors and Nets are playing in a playoff series, and it'll be the first time that the Raptors win one of those series. So that'll be nice.
Wow, just spoiling our playoff previews. All of them.
The Grand Floridian, by the way. F the Grand Floridian.
Oh, that's perfect.
Sorry we said the fuck word earlier. I will censor it now and say F the Grand Floridian.
Well, Florida man. The Florida man. Well, it's just we can call them that for the whole series.
Yes. All right. Before, like I said, we're going to have all that series preview content for you later in the week. As a reminder, theathletic.com/we the six for 40% off a subscription if you do not already subscribe and would like to check out our playoff content. We have some pretty good deep dives heading into each series coming up, and then obviously things like game night coverage, my Raptors recalibrations, keeping up with the stories of the series as much as we can, and we'll try to, as much as is reasonable, collaborate with beat writers from the opponent teams. That way we get those alternate perspectives as well. And as a reminder, if you subscribe to The Athletic for the Raptors, you do get things like the Nets coverage and the Heat coverage and Celtics and Bucks and all that stuff. We have a pretty good staff in this Eastern Conference playoff picture. So please do that, because we would like to stay employed. And yeah, now we can talk about the actual games that have happened. Eric, the Raptors are now locked into the 2 seed in the Eastern Conference, despite losing to the Boston Celtics on Friday. They lost in an ugly one, 122-100, but they bounced back. They beat the Grizzlies for the Naismith Cup. They beat the Bucks with no Giannis, Lowry, Van Vliet, or Ibaka. They now have won 50 games yet again. It's like, I think, 7 straight years that they've topped the old franchise record for wins in a season. They become, I think, just the 5th NBA champion to improve their regular season winning percentage the next year, which is pretty incredible. Eric, they're in good shape, big picture, I think.
Yes.
They're a good team, is what I'm trying to say.
I think that's accurate. I think they are good, and they are one of the 6 best teams in the NBA, I would say.
Are you including Houston as the number 6 there?
Yeah. Yes.
That's fine. I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah. I mean,
Boston would be the 5th, I'd imagine, right?
Absolutely.
Cool.
Absolutely. Should we talk about Boston?
We could talk about that game. Like I guess the biggest thing I'm curious about it from your take, and obviously, you know, that was not the Raptors' best game. I think a lot of that, and the Raptors would tell you as much, was it fell more in the, like, intangible side of things, if you want to credit the effort and energy and stuff like that. They were not themselves.
Yeah.
However, Boston is a tougher matchup on paper. Boston's now pasted them twice. And yes, one of those games was without Siakam, Gasol, and Norman Powell. And that same shorthanded Raptors team also pasted the Celtics once. But I'm wondering just, like, what did you take from that game in terms of, like, things you might be concerned about if those two teams meet up in the second round, which looks kind of likely.
Yeah, considering Boston's most likely opponent is Ben Simmons-less Philadelphia 76ers in the first round, and who knows how Joel Embiid is. It sounds like it's not going to be too serious with his ankle injury.
Sorry, before you actually get to answer the question that I asked you, can nice. I just lay out like what I think the ideal scenario is for Raptors fans here?
I mean, it's your podcast, so go ahead. It's
our podcast.
Yeah, no. Just ask me a question, then keep talking. It's fine.
Yeah. Oh, as if you wouldn't do that if you were the lead podcast host.
It's fine, Blake. Go ahead.
So you mentioned the Simmons-less 76ers. I think the best case scenario for the Raptors is the Simmons-less 76ers actually beat the Celtics in the 3-6 matchup because they find some level of offense, like four out around Joel Embiid, and play kind of like the Van Gundy Dwight magic. And they don't have quite, you know, they don't have Turkoglu and Rashard Lewis to execute that necessarily, but they could get a little better offensively, I think. So then you would get the double edge of Celtics panic because they lost in the first round of the 76ers shorthanded. 76ers panic because, oh no, are they better without Simmons? They're not, but they, you know, should they trade Simmons and all that kind of stuff? And, you know, you get I think the Simmons-less 76ers are a better matchup for the Raptors than the Celtics would be. So you would cause 76ers and Celtics internal strife and get a slightly easier playoff opponent.
That'd be a beautiful thing.
That'd be a best-case scenario for Raptors fans, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Philadelphia doesn't have the shooters or playmaking to do it, but
How dare you doubt Shake Milton and the other players that they have with all these injuries? No, it's funny. I saw someone tweet the other day, and I mentioned this on the Sam Vecini's Game Theory podcast that I was on this week, and we kind of did a East rundown. And I apologize to whoever it was, because I can't remember who tweeted it, but if you had Josh Richardson, Tobias Harris, and Al Horford on a team, you would pick them to finish sixth in the East. And this team also has Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons and is going to finish sixth in the East.
What a Sixers year. It's like, I mean, the parallels between them and the Leafs are just hilarious.
It's amazing. And I know people jump on, well, the Sixers have actually got out of the first round, and I get that. But, like, roster construction-wise, process-wise, what the issues are-wise, they're so similar.
Like, in terms of comparing between sports, which is always a dicey proposition.
Yes. Everyone always wants to give the Leafs to the Knicks, but the Knicks don't make the playoffs. The Knicks are the Oilers.
Yes. I mean, the Oilers did have that one year where they went to the conference finals, but I guess
that's the mellow 50
the Knicks,
win year.
Yeah, the Knicks did have that 54-win season. Anyway,
so are you worried about the Celtics?
Yes, I am. I was before that game, and I think that game just served to prove as further nightmare fuel, I guess, let's call it. Not to overreact, because all of those, you know, the previous games did happen. There was one close game this year that happened like 19 months ago that could have gone either way. And Pascal Siakam was great in that game. Marc Gasol was really good in that game, which was two things we didn't see, which were two things we didn't see. Oh, no, I can't speak. In last Friday's game. But the biggest thing I would say was they are long and athletic, and it might be tough to get Kyle Lowry and Fred VanVleet going in said series. I would guess they're going to have to rely on a lot of Pascal Siakam playmaking. Because of that, there was just, it seemed like there were a lot of Lowry and Van Vliet drives that took them under the net, and then all of a sudden there was just nothing going on, so they had to dribble all the way out, and then, you know, there are 10 seconds left on the clock. It's worrisome. And even Gasol, who I think has been largely great defensively, got caught flat-footed in some schemes, in some defensive situations when they were beaten around one of Daniel Tice's monstrous screens. Daniel Tice was really good in that game.
Good.
Yeah, he's a good player. He's a good role player, knows what he's doing, knows what he's supposed to do within the context of the team. So yeah, I'm concerned. I mean, the Raptors certainly didn't throw a terribly complicated scheme out at the Celtics. They probably weren't trying quite as hard as they always do, although I will say they were trying levels or, you know, they were trying way harder than the Milwaukee Bucks were yesterday. Let's just try that. Let's say that. I think it was evident when they were making that abbreviated comeback attempt, like this wasn't a team that was trying to get slapped around. It just was because the Celtics are that dangerous. I don't think the Celtics are like 40 points better than the Raptors, certainly, but it exposed some of the matchup worries, and I think those are real.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the more interesting wrinkles in a potential series, and this is going to cut both ways, because I think if you look at Boston, especially in a playoff series against a team like Toronto, one of your concerns is how deep can they go? And I know they used 13 guys in that game, although three of them were just garbage time. Like, Shemmy hit three of his threes in that game, but is he like can the Raptors help off of him too much on offense in a playoff series? Brad Wanamaker played 24 minutes in that game and was great, and I love the Wanamaker story, but I don't know how big a role he has in this series. Even Robert Williams, like, I think everyone knows I'm very fond of Time Lord, and I like him better in that backup spot for Boston against Toronto than I do Cantor, even though Cantor's a huge problem on the offensive glass and has, like, gotten better in the drop coverage defensively. I think Time Lord's rim protection and vertical threat is a little more natural a fit opposite the Raptors in a playoff series. But I think if you're Boston, you're only locked in to six guys in major roles, and Kemba Walker doesn't really look 100% through these reseeding games. So on one hand, you know, you're probably a little concerned about the depth on Boston's side. On the other hand, the players that Boston does trust are pretty well aligned to take advantage of what the Raptors defense offers up. Obviously, they're all pretty good defenders as well, except for Kemba, and you can bet that the Raptors are going to be hunting Kemba mismatches as much as they can. I think even that's even more likely than Hayward mismatches, just because Hayward's gotten pretty competent on those post-ups and stuff. But I think, you know, if you're designing a way to beat the Raptors, it's probably with a lot of shooting on the floor, and the fact that everyone in their rotation can shoot except for maybe Marcus Smart. And Marcus Smart is such a willing shooter. Like, Marcus Smart and Jay Crowder were both Raptors opponents in recent games. And I think they're a perfect example of something Seth Partnow has written about a bunch for us at The Athletic, which is, you know, it's almost more important. I'm paraphrasing Seth's point poorly here, but to oversimplify, it's almost more important to be a willing three-point shooter than an effective one, because a defense like the Raptors isn't going to worry that much about a guy who isn't confident shooting in the corner, whereas a Marcus Smart you kind of want to scramble out to because you know he's going to let it fly. So, you know, you see these Marc Gasol or OG Anunoby half jogs at Jay Crowder, while Marcus Smart, even as a, you know, a relative non-shooter percentage-wise, you're probably going to get out to him because you know those shots are going up, and he, you know, he's settled in as like a 35% three-point shooter the last 2 years, so it's not nothing either, although he did go 0-5 in that game. So I do think that surrounding, you know, whether it's Tatum, whether it's Kemba, having a lot of shooting around those guys, even Tice can hit the corner three, you know, I do think that that can introduce some problems for the Raptors. And they got buried in this game, despite the Celtics only shooting 35% on their threes. And they went 10 of 16 in the corners, which probably isn't sustainable. But also 6 of 30 above the break probably isn't sustainable. So, you know, that's not even a defensive performance you can hang on three-point shooting variance. So, definitely some concerns there. Within that, you know, from that game, you wrote about Pascal Siakam. Siakam was 5 of 15, 0 free throw attempts, 0 assists, 11 points, and 2 turnovers in that one. He did have, the only other game he played against Boston this year was the second game of the season. He had 33, 8, and 2 in that one. A little bit of turnover trouble still, but he was more aggressive getting into the paint. He obviously hit 5 of 7 on threes, which helps that line a little bit. But Siakam has been a little uneven in the return to play here. Over 6 games, he's averaging 17.2 points, which is fine. He's only averaging 33 minutes, so he's still, you know, around 18 per 36, a little higher than that. So I guess where the concern comes in is, one, he's been really reliant on the three to get those points. It's great that he has the pull-up three and the above-the-break three in his bag now. We've already seen how helpful that can be late in a game, how helpful that can be when a team is, you know, guarding his ability to drive a lot better. But he's only shooting 40% overall. He's only averaging 3.5 free throw attempts. He's only averaging 2 assists to 2.5 turnovers. I don't want to dump on him because I thought process-wise, there's some good stuff. He's passed out of post-ups well. He's not really forcing it. Like, he hasn't had a game where, you know, maybe the Lakers game, he pressed a little too much. And the Orlando game, he had some turnovers, but scored at a decent rate. But I guess it's just, it's not that he's been bad necessarily, but he hasn't been the Siakam that he's shown flashes of a lot this season. And he definitely hasn't been the Siakam yet that the Raptors will need him to be when you look to the second round and forward. And I think the Boston game highlighted that, because however you feel about Siakam versus Jason Tatum right now, and obviously that's something I wrote a lot about during the offseason, those two and Ben Simmons and how they stack up in the East. I think Tatum's a little bit ahead right now, and I think in that game, even though Tatum didn't take over offensively or anything, what you saw was a guy who's a little bit more comfortable using that defensive attention to help his teammates out. I also think Siakam has a higher defensive ceiling than Tatum, but Tatum has been a little more even and consistent this year, especially in the relaunch. But Eric, I guess what I'm asking is, what do you have a concern level with Siakam? Is this just him getting his footing and ramping up, or, you know, are we, obviously this was one of our big talking points of the hiatus of, is where can he go as the number one guy, and where can the Raptors go with him as the number one guy? Not long term, because he's still got plenty of time to figure all this out, but in the short term here, as the playoffs are 2 games away.
Yeah, if I had to isolate my concerns with Siakam, it's probably as a attacker from the perimeter. I think that's where a lot of the mistakes are coming. And look, it's, you know, the dude has really long arms, and that puts all the more pressure on your handle to be very, very tight, because it's easier to steal a ball from a guy whose arms spread out to 7'2" or whatever they do than it is from Kyle Lowry or Fred VanVleet.
Just ask the Raptors how easy it is to get in under the hands of a big.
Yeah. Who, you know, Fred VanVleet. Who did he take the ball from the other game against Memphis?
Anthony Tolliver. Poor Anthony Tolliver, forced to play 30 minutes and left out there to die at the end of that game.
I love Anthony Tolliver as a role player. I just think, like, he's done his job for so long, he should be applauded. And it, like, he's done it pretty well for a bunch of middling teams, but yeah, he's
certainly a member of the Kenneth Faried All-Stars of, should the Raptors trade for this guy, or should the Raptors try to sign this guy on the buyout market?
Oh, I thought they should have done that this year. But obviously, Anthony Tolliver went somewhere where he's going to play 30 minutes a game. So, yeah.
Plus, if you're the Raptors, you know, you need that roster space to not play Malcolm Miller even on a night when you only have 12 guys dressed and Stanley Johnson is playing as Stanley Johnson does.
Some saltiness.
Look, Stanley Johnson has the best net rating on the team since the relaunch. So who am I? Who am I to doubt Stanley Johnson?
Point Stanley.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's where we've seen most of the issues. Like, Siakam got going a bit there in the third quarter against Boston, and it mostly came from concerted efforts to get him going in the post. And I think you know, he's not always been great from the post this year, but he has that those collection of spin moves and pivots that make him a really effective player. And if you want to be optimistic about what he can do against the Celtics, you look at those first few minutes from the third quarter and see how he found a way to score. And as you said, he's generally looked good passing out of the post. And even against the Bucks on Monday, he was sort of taking the ball down the court and getting in the post right away by himself. And then, you know, help was coming and he was moving it. And so if you want that, that's, I don't know if it's progress, but it's confirmed that he's definitely taken a step since last year from there, let's say. But I think it's fair to worry about his handle, and it's fair to worry about his decision making when he does put the ball on the floor. And like the Raptors, Boston has a lot of smart defenders. Some of those smart defenders are literally named smart. They also have longer arms than the Raptors. Some of the Raptors defenders do, and there's going to be a lot of swiping at his dribble. And if it's loose, that's going to result in turnovers. So I think that's an issue. It's an issue the Raptors are going to have to game plan with in mind. You hope that Siakam can tighten it up in these last two games. I assume, or not two games, also the playoff games, although Brooklyn plays a very different style than Boston would play. But it's, you know, if you're thinking about Siakam both short-term and long-term, I think that's the issue, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, the Raptors can do some stuff to help him out a little bit more. You know, we're going to see in a playoff series more Siakam guard pick and roll, which is very effective when they go to it, and it's kind of a late game staple. And Siakam does have this, you know, monstrous efficiency and usage in the clutch, so that's encouraging. There are process side ways that they can make this a little easier on him and start to tick upwards. So, you know, I don't know if worry is the right word, but it's certainly, like, entering the bubble, we said that was the number one thing to watch with this Raptors team, because their half-court offense is their biggest weakness, and, you know, despite good numbers out of timeouts and good numbers in the clutch, you know, how this looks over the 70 possessions you have to play a game in the half-court is a big question, especially if transition opportunities shrink in the playoffs as they did last year. So
yeah, I would worry just in the context of the Celtics, because it's so hard for Lowry and Van Vliet to create those opportunities, not so hard, but comparatively hard for them to act as facilitators in the same way that they normally do, because of all the length that they face once they do get into the paint. So it's a concern. That's not to say the Celtics don't have concerns when they play the Raptors, but
exactly.
But these are two really good teams, and that's sort of where I stand with that. And I mean, I think they should have a good long series to figure it out, and it will be very educational.
Sure will be. Before we get back to the show, let's take a minute to hear about Indochino. The Raptors, let's be a little more positive for a minute here. The Raptors are 5-1 in the bubble. They are the best defense in the bubble so far, I think, qualitatively, and then also statistically by a huge margin. They are allowing only 99.5 points per 100 possessions. The next closest defense is allowing 5 more points per 100 possessions. That's even larger than the season-long gap between the Bucks and Raptors for 1 and 2 in defensive rating. Yes, they got the Magic and the Grizzlies in there, but they also played the Bucks and the Celtics and the Heat and the Lakers, and they've had, you know, we talked a lot coming in here about how this was going to be a good schedule to test them and get ready, and they've been terrific on defense. What hasn't been terrific is that a lot of their success has been isolated to the starting lineup of Lowry, Van Vliet, Anunoby, Siakam, and Gasol. Even after pounding on the Bucks as a starter in kind of that shorthanded game on Monday, Norman Powell has a pretty sizable negative net rating in the bubble so far. Serge Ibaka didn't have the benefit of that Bucks game, but he has a large negative as well. Terrence Davis and Rondae Hollis Jefferson have also posted large negative net ratings. And obviously all of this stuff is super noisy in a six-game window, especially when you get the bench guys that aren't playing a lot of minutes and stuff. But I'm wondering, Eric, if you're concerned that the Raptors rotation right now, to hear Nick Nurse tell it, even after strong performances from Matt Thomas and Chris Boucher on Monday, looks like a 7, maybe 8-man rotation. And until the last two games, Powell and Ibaka really hadn't been going.
Yeah, you'd like to see more players performing well. Only
having 5 players playing well is a concern. Okay, yeah. Good to know.
I mean, Nurse said as much after the Boston game, and he basically didn't want to say anything about the Boston game. It was sort of strange in terms of a guy who is generally pretty candid with us, which we appreciate, but he didn't want to lend too much credence to anything that happened in that contest. But yeah, like, it's hard to find transitional units if you don't have more than 5 players who are playing well. And that's something you wrote about, I believe, before the bubble. Time is, you know, a mystery. I think it was before the bubble, or just before the first game, rather.
You can tell me I wrote something in mid-March or last week at this point, and yeah, I would believe you.
Yeah, you wrote about it at some point. It was informative. Go search it. Go search for it.
It was right before. Anyway, it was during the scrimmage games.
Oh, yes. The scrimmage games. And boy, does that Raptors loss to Phoenix look understandable now.
Also, I know that we can't do this because it would skew regular season numbers that are going to be important in retrospect. But I really wish that instead of those games having counted as preseason and these games counting as regular season, like, I really wish we could look at stats that were
just bubble
games
stats.
Plus scrimmages. Yeah.
Yeah. Bubble stats. Anyway. I'm sure some genius has those numbers.
Oh yeah. I'm sure Jacob Goldstein will get them for me if I really ask.
Oh yeah. You don't want to use those privileges willy nilly.
Not for something like this. I save those asks for things like G League player impact plus minus. How else would I be so high on plus 20.7 net rating and infinite foul rate, Paul Watson? Infinite free throw rate, I should say. He's not fouling. Yeah, he's just living at the line.
But yeah, like, individually, am I concerned about Powell and Ibaka? Not that much. Like, Powell looked really good against the Bucks. He showed signs of life against the whatever team that was, the Grizzlies, and I think his process has been pretty good. Like, he's missing some layups that he hit earlier in the year, and I think, as we said at this time last week and maybe this time 2 weeks ago, he's probably not a 50-40-90 guy, so for some of that, those looks to not be falling isn't a huge surprise, and I think he's doing pretty well. And Ibaka is sort of looked like the guy he was last year when Marc Gasol was, you know, I think what we have to remember about Serge Ibaka is that he was essentially the starting center for large portions of this year because Gasol missed upwards of, you know, around 30 games. So it's a lot. And when you think about it, and when you think about the Bucks game as a whole, it's a lot easier to get into a groove either in a single game or in many games when you have certainty in role and certainty in minutes, and those roles are just bigger. Now Ibaka has to come off the bench and figure out how to be impactful there. And what we saw last year is some games he'll be really good at that. He'll come in as a defensive spark and he'll be running the floor and his shot will look good. And some games he will be flat and you'll be wanting Gasol back in there immediately. And I think, you know, you would hope that Ibaka's shooting carries over more than that and that he can be a more immediate threat coming off the bench. But, you know, his track record says that might be a little too much to ask. So I'd say if there was one of the 7 guys who I'm most concerned about, it's probably Ibaka right now. But I think he'll more or less be fine. And yeah, like 8 through 10 or 8 through 11, other than Matt Thomas, who's great now, like, that's a concern. I think you wanted to see Terrence Davis pick up where he left off. He certainly hasn't. I thought he made a few really good process plays against the Bucks, and that's promising. He was also active in terms of his energy, you know, with a few tip-ins and even missed layups, but he was doing the right things in transition, and that's sort of what they need him to be. So if he can settle into that role, that goes a long way toward calming things down, but he just hasn't been good yet, and you know, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson is just problematic to fit in offensively, and I think we've seen that, and that, you know, I fear will only lay itself bare in the playoffs.
I don't know, man. I really dig the Hollis-Jefferson-Lowry inverted pick and roll, where Lowry sets a screen below the free throw line, and it just lets Hollis-Jefferson drive basically into extra bodies, but Lowry's in the way so no one can get a hand on the shot. It's beautiful.
Yeah, no, I do like the notion of, like, Matt Thomas playing a career game against Milwaukee, and then, like, them giving him the game ball or something. This didn't happen, by the way. But then saying, we're going to have to fine you your game salary because you passed up a shot to give it to Rondae in the corner. Sorry about that. Enjoy the game ball.
I believe Rondae took an above the break three last night, too.
Yeah, I think so.
If you remember earlier in the year, he got immediately pulled from a game for doing that.
He's fun. He's active. And like, I, you know,
and like, he's got to get it going, because against Milwaukee, like, if they get to the conference finals, like, you want him to not be cold and rusty, because like, you probably need him for a couple minutes against Giannis here and there.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, the Raptors rotation has no non-shooters in it. It does have some of those guys who we were talking about earlier who are not necessarily guys who love to shoot. I'm talking mostly about Marc Gasol here, but even sometimes OG Anunoby is hesitant to take the open shot, and you know, on his worst days, that can happen to Kyle Lowry too.
Lowry, the worst shooter in the Raptors rotation, by the way, this year.
But I think if having no non-shooters should make it easier for Rondae Hollis-Jefferson to fit in on offense, because he does have some gifts there. Like, despite his six turnovers, and most of which came in like him being the prime, you know, ball handler or playmaker on the perimeter against the Bucks. Like, he's a good passer. He's an intuitive player. He's a good cutter. You know, which could make him work well with Gasol.
Sorry to cut you off. That's something that
I love being cut off, because it means I don't have to finish a sentence. Go on.
Yeah, I mean, we do have like a decent sample, and this is one of the things that I went into in that, you know, when I tried to break down what a rotation would look like with different transitional lineups, is we have a good sample that Hollis-Jefferson and Ibaka is an awkward fit. And I think, like, not only do the numbers in a smaller sample say Hollis-Jefferson and Gasol can work, I think intuitively they just make more sense together. And I know Hollis-Jefferson's actual playoff role is probably, like the clearest path might be if the Raptors go to, like, a Siakam, Anunoby, Hollis-Jefferson front court at some point, or one of those even larger lineups. But I think if you can find a way to get him out there with Gasol instead of Ibaka, and you know, obviously you don't redesign the whole rotation around Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, but I think there's a good case that Gasol could see more minutes helping those bench units anyway.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, let's not contort our entire rotation around Rondae Hollis-Jefferson's needs, but at some point it does circle back to the team's needs, and you can't afford those 5-minute you know, stretches where you struggle to score against really good teams in the playoffs. So these are the things that will have to be considered, and that hopefully Nick Nurse and his staff are thinking about in the back of their minds, but like, you don't need to see implemented immediately other than to give them some reps so they're not doing these things for the first time in, you know, game three against Boston.
Yeah. Okay. So in terms of these back rotation battles, we know the top seven. Eight was presumed a Terrence Davis-Patrick McCaw battle. Patrick McCaw has left the bubble to have a benign mass removed from his left knee for the second time this year. So for the foreseeable future, that is a Terrence Davis-Matt Thomas kind of battle. I don't think Boucher or Hollis-Jefferson has made any real headway ahead of the other. Like, obviously, Boucher had the game of his life on Monday, but it wasn't, you know, it was a Chris Boucher 25-point game output in a game that didn't matter.
I don't know, Blake. You said it was important to have willing shooters out there.
It is. but I mostly just mean that, like, Hollis Jefferson and Boucher, your decision on which of those two to play in a playoff series is probably almost entirely matchup dependent anyway.
Yes.
So I don't know that Boucher could, like, even if he was averaging 20 in these games, I don't know that that would fundamentally change, you know, when Hollis Jefferson might see a window. So I guess the biggest question coming out of the Milwaukee game, and it's something, again, that I wrote about heading into the bubble and we've talked about a little bit, but what can Matt Thomas do, or what can the Raptors do to get him on the floor in a playoff series? Because we've seen his team defense improve. We know he's going to be surrounded usually by four quality defenders. Opponents will attack him, but you can survive that a little bit. He's obviously not, you know, a plus defender, but the Rockets didn't score on possessions where he was on Harden and where he was on Westbrook. Eric Gordon kind of had his way, but you can scheme around it a little bit. And then on offense, you know, he's such a game changer with his spacing and his shooting. I think my biggest request for these last two games is that Matt Thomas get 9 more three-point attempts, because if you remember earlier in the year when I kept artificially depressing the three-point cutoff to 75 attempts so I could fit Matt Thomas on the leaderboards, that would get him to 100 attempts, and 100 is a nice round number that I can at least justify, and it won't look quite as much like I just put the cutoff at wherever Matt Thomas is.
Is he going to qualify for the leaderboards?
No, but he could qualify better for my unofficial ones.
Okay. So that's what's important.
Yes. So he's 43 of 91 right now, which is 47.3%. I thought against the Bucks, he showed kind of what I tried to highlight in that pre-bubble breakdown, which is he's not just a catch-and-shoot guy. He does have that push-ahead move. He can come off a screen. You know, we saw him take advantage of the Bucks' drop coverage a couple of times, and he can make a pass, too. So I think offensively, we're at a point now where we can start thinking of Thomas as more than just a catch-and-shoot specialist. He's just a good offensive player, and maybe could even have a little bit more pick-and-roll handling in those units that lack it. But the big question is still going to be, how much can you play him on defense? So I'm wondering where you're at with Thomas, Eric, and whether you could see him carving out more than like 4 or 5 minutes in a playoff series.
I mean, if everybody's healthy, it's difficult to see that game in and game out, at least once we're getting to the bigger series, later in the playoffs. But I think we're getting there, you know? Like Brooklyn, certainly, like, without however many players they're missing, there's just fewer guys that you're worried about them hunting matchups for. Like, if, you know, it's one thing if they can get it to Caris LeVert to make that happen, but anybody else, like, I'm really not overly concerned about them looking to find that matchup, and I don't think that's the way Brooklyn really wants to play anyway, is matchup hunting.
You're not worried about the Justin Anderson revenge game?
I mean, perpetually, sure, but I think if that's the path that the Nets are going to take, then I think you have to begrudgingly let them take it. So I think, you know, you want to see how he performs in these last two games for sure. But he's certainly showed enough. His basketball IQ goes both ways, and he's definitely more limited defensively. And again, like, just picturing him in that Boston series would be a nightmare, just because, you know, they have three or four guys who you'd hate to be able to ISO on him. But a team that's less dangerous on the perimeter, it's an easier fit. So I don't think much is going to change on that end, other than to say, if Terrence Davis doesn't improve defensively, and I don't think he's been terrible, but he also fouled out in 17 minutes, which isn't promising. I think his game was actually pretty good against the Bucks, but 6 fouls in 17 minutes is 6 fouls in 17 minutes, as they say. I'm not sure who they is. But if he continues to be unreliable on that end, which is the major concern, I would say, it's going to put Thomas in a more feasible playing situation. Whether Nurse elects to go just with a straight 7 plus Rondé cameos in that scenario, we'll have to see. But given the offensive struggles that they've been having, and that was the concern heading into the bubble, was their half-court offense. They might be behooved to find a, you know, 10-minute role for Matt Thomas in certain matchups.
So
was that wishy-washy enough?
Yeah, to kind of wrap this up and take us back to close on the Nets before we do a series preview podcast later in the week, I guess the biggest thing I'm curious about trying to put myself in Nick Nurse's shoes is we've had three scrimmages and six reseeding games, and it really hasn't offered any clarity on the bench questions that we came into Orlando with. The Raptors are going to be favored significantly against the Nets. I think right now I'd probably pick Raptors in five, just because the Nets shoot so many threes, you could probably high variance your way into a win in like a game Caris LeVert scores 35 and the guys around him shoot 45% or whatever. But the Raptors are going to be very big favorites. With only two reseeding games left and a need to figure out some of this back rotation stuff for the second round and beyond, Eric, do you think it would be too risky or too hubristic to enter the Nets series planning to have a deeper rotation so that you can get more information on some of these guys in a playoff environment? Not that Brooklyn is going to be, like you said, the test that a Boston or Philly or whoever is going to be, but it's still, there's still playoff games, and there's still games where you're going to be seeing the same opponent multiple times, and they can, you know, Jacque Vaughn is coaching for his job and is going to try to do as good a job as he can, and they have some dangerous players. Would you be okay going into this series thinking, hey, they're going to run 9, maybe 10 guys out there and see how they look and see what sticks? Or if you're Nurse, are you just, you know, hey, it's playoffs, I'm shrinking it to the 7 guys I trust and then matchup specialty beyond that?
Shoot, until like you're trailing in the series, I mean, that's a bit extreme. But until you lose, maybe, like, that's a fine approach, I think. We'll see what, again, there are 2 more games left. I don't know how much the regulars are going to play. I imagine a little bit. I don't think they'll want Lowry or Van Vliet's or Ibaka's last game to have been more than a week before the playoffs start. So maybe they do get some more time against Denver and Philadelphia, and then you find out how those bench players fit in what might be more of a realistic rotation. Because that's sort of the problem with projecting from the Milwaukee game is, you know, Matt Thomas playing great in a 37-minute role doesn't necessarily help you that much in how he might fit in a 12-minute role. So I think you want to see some of that while, like, keeping Lowry and Van Vliet and Siakam hopefully below 30 minutes or whatever it might be. But yeah, like this, they should be confident going into the Brooklyn series. And, you know, after they lose game one, maybe you tighten things up. But I think the idea of going in with 9 or 10 guys isn't a bad one in that series. And I think you have to be willing to acknowledge the context of the season for what it is. It's not a normal season. They didn't have a normal run up to the playoffs, and they, you know, they're really good. I think this whole season has proven that. Like, it's the notion of them losing 4 times in 7 games to a clearly inferior opponent is preposterous, because the Raptors are really good against inferior opponents. So I think you can be confident in yourselves and look to see what makes sense. And saying all of that, I'm not sure how much multiple games against Brooklyn prepare you for multiple games against Boston, but it's what you have, and you need to use the resources at your disposal.
Brooklyn, by the way, has 13 guys out on their latest injury report. So,
they are one of the zoniest teams, I believe. And yes. I don't know if that's played out in the bubble that much. I think I heard Spoelstra talking about how they zoned up the Heat a lot. I have to be real, I haven't seen a lot of Nets basketball. Apparently they've been inspiring.
Yeah, they've been fun.
The Cinderella Nets.
Yeah. I mean, look, everyone knows that we are Caris LeVert fans on this podcast.
Yeah.
You know, Jared Allen's kind of fun. Joe Harris is, you know, the world's best shooter, who's also a big indie pro wrestling fan. They have Justin Anderson. That's cool.
Yeah. The Raptors are better than them, and they should be confident in being better than them, because they're better than most teams. And
yeah, I don't know about Tyler Johnson, 30 minutes in a playoff series, but we're going to talk about that more in our series preview podcast.
The man threw up when he got a $50 million contract offer. Let's not forget that.
Yeah.
Although I might, too.
Not a great contract, though.
Yeah, well, good for him.
All right. The Raptors have two games remaining. They play the Philadelphia 76ers on Wednesday. That'll be the second game of a back-to-back for the 76ers. We don't know if Joel Embiid will play. He is out Tuesday. I'd imagine they're going to take that pretty cautious, and I doubt that they have a huge preference between the 5 seed and the 6 seed. They may, if they think they're going to be good with Embiid, they might even prefer the 6 seed because you avoid Milwaukee's side of the bracket. But I think the 76ers are just trying to survive right now. And then the Raptors will wrap up against Denver on Friday at 1:30 p.m. Denver still jockeying for seeding a little bit, but looks like the likely 3 seed out west. I would expect a couple Raptors to rest. Maybe not in the Denver game. Maybe Denver ends up being one of those, like, they play the first two quarters and the first 6 minutes of the third quarter just to stay fresh or whatever. But also, if the first playoff game is Monday, maybe they just don't want guys playing in that one. The lack of schedule clarity confuses that to some degree. But I don't think either of those games will be terribly informative. But I think the stuff we talked about today with the bench guys and Siakam are the biggest things to look for, because Siakam is going to have some pretty good defenders on him in those games. The Raptors' defense is still going to get tested against Denver if Jokic plays and Jamal Murray plays. You know, we saw the Raptors try to combat that with no center earlier in the year. Who knows? Maybe Gasol and Ibaka both sit and we just get another OG on Jokic game. anyway, I don't think they'll be too informative, but as was the case with these six games so far and the three scrimmage games, you're looking for stuff at the individual player level, and there's still a lot to figure out with the bench. We will be back to preview the first round series between the Raptors and the Nets later this week or very, very early next week. I think that podcast will come out Monday morning at the very latest, so keep your eyes out for that. If you want more on the top of the East, I did appear on Sam Vecenie's Game Theory podcast on Monday, which you can check out. We kind of hit on the top six teams in the East. A lot of Raptors talk, but some TJ Warren love and some 76ers confusion mixed in there as well. So go check that out. Eric Kareen, thank you for this, man.
Blake, it is usually a pleasure.
Is that to say it wasn't this time?
No, it was this time.
Oh. Well, you said it usually is.
And it usually is. Okay. Including this time.
All right. Well, thanks, man. I will, I'll talk to you soon for that preview podcast with Alex.
Thanks, guys. See ya.